Well, I know you've got a lot to do, so I know it's not a small thing that you're actually here this afternoon. So I promised to make this short, and I think it can be a lot of stuff we can go through very quickly because Stefan did such a good job in the introduction earlier. So the goal is to take the simplest system and just look at some simple, very simple things so that we have a nice picture in our heads of what's going on. I found it to be very useful and it's something I kind of carry around with me that works when I read other people's work that are in fields that aren't necessarily the same application, but it's still optimal control. And and this little this has turned out to be kind of I had to come up with a title kind of quick, and this kind of occurred to me. But it's, as time's gone on, it seems to be amenable to a lot of applications for what the talk will be about. And like I said earlier, we're all speaking maybe slightly different dialects, and if the dialect's really strong, maybe you can't quite understand the dialect. But music is something, no matter where you're from, everybody understands music. They don't need translation and stuff. So I kind of thought, well, I didn't plan on that, but that's the way it worked out. But what I really was thinking of originally was simple things, the beauty and richness in very simple systems and how much you can do with very simple things. And if it's good enough for Mozart, it's good enough for me, was kind of the attitude. So here's something we can skip very quickly. We saw this earlier this morning, and Stefan covered a good part of this, sketching out at least what's going on. And I'll be pretty much down here in this little corner with this bebop is broadband excitation by optimized pulses and this great algorithm and numerical results. So it's pretty much right down here. And then Burkhardt, I think tomorrow will be covering some more things on pulse limits and some other things. We saw some of this earlier this morning, but it doesn't hurt to see things twice in a different fashion. And maybe there's some people here that weren't here this morning. And for the non-NMR community, as Stefan explained, we have an applied field, which either the RF field B1 or in frequency or radians per second units. This is the Larmor frequency, right? Omega is gamma, the Geiger-Megner ratio times B1. This is the applied field. So everything in the system gets this field applied to it, which is something, as I spoke to Mikhail, I understood is what is in some of the. I don't know what Mikhail didn't also know what to give me a term to call the atomic or molecular people, whatever, the non-NMR people, whatever you're doing with atomic and molecular physics. He explained to me that yes, indeed, you have lots of electrons, but all your electrons are coupled in the same way to this field that you apply. But in NMR, as Stefan showed you this morning, different spins in the sample that are in different electronic environments, in particular, see slightly different fields than the static field, the polarization field. So the effect of that is that they get this off resonance field, as he showed you. And so, again, I like the way Mikhail, I hadn't said it this way, but each of these different spins couples in a different way to the field. That's, I guess, the language you use. So they're seeing a slightly different field. And then it has to, so they're each going to rotate at the Larmor frequency for however long this field is around this effective field. So, real quick, just some, I've got some, here's an applied field, here's some offset that's about, if this is in units of one, this is like 0.7 or 0.75, each of these plus or minus, and then there's these color-coded spins sitting here lined up around the field, so it'll just do the normal thing, and if it, oh, you know, we're not on the, here, sorry, we're not even in the, I see what's going on. We're not even in the, we are. So I guess we're not in, so maybe this is another complication. We're not in this in, on the screen, I've got the, I'm not in the send it to the screen mode. So there we go.
If you have the mouse across.
Yeah, I got it. Well, so here's the, it's going on my screen. So I saw it. It was beautiful. So, do you know a trick to fix? Yeah. So you see here it's going. So in fact, somehow this remembers that this is up here, and no matter what he's changed on the screen. With laptops on displays or something when I go back. Okay, hit it and see if it goes.
Wow.
This is the normal thing. Again, we're adding Ilya to the list of collaborators on the talk, of course.
Well, I've got to do something first.
Because there's no talk without you up here, so we can display it. But anyway, so you see that these process at the Larmor frequency about the field, no big deal. Except that, of course, now each spin, if we try to design a pulse to send them, ideally we want them all to end up, let's say, at the x-axis here, as the on-resonance spin did. But a given pulse element is going to send them all in different directions, and it becomes increasingly worse as we go to larger offsets. Typically, if your offset is on the order of your B1 field, you at least, as in the previous slide, you got them pretty close, at least to the transverse plane. But if we go farther off resonance, like this is like 1 3/4 or something, and again, Stefan showed you this, they're not even going to get to the transverse plane, right? So how do you get them all to the transverse plane? You have to have different pulse elements. And just a simple example, a composite pi pulse has this. What you're going to see here is the. I brought this so I wouldn't have to do this. Walk up to the screen. But what you're going to see here is the original field like this, with these off resonance about 0.3 times this basic unit. So it'll do a 90 around these off resonance fields, and rotating around this field is the same as rotating in the opposite sense around the negative field, just as a picture. So it'll rotate around this, do a 90, then it'll shift phase where the same things will be, these won't be put over here, but that's what you're supposed to understand, is that in the next part of it, these will shift phase and be along the x-axis, so then it'll rotate 180 degrees, so that all the spins that were fanning out in the first 90 will flip around 180 degrees, so that then when we flip this, shift this back to the y-axis, then they tend to sort of move back closer together. So they come down to the transverse plane, sort of, then it shifts phase along this x-axis, so they at least kind of come back around here. Now the red ones are going to tend to come back together a little bit more, and instead of going way away from the, increasingly far away from the minus z-axis for an inversion pulse, they at least, it doesn't do great, but at least it gets closer than it would have. And so this is the kind of tricks that have been played over many, really a good 10 to 20 years of NMR in designing pulses that are tolerant to resonance offsets, or this pulse even does better if you have these variations in the strength of the magnetic field as a function of spin. And Stefan showed an example of that. But the lots of pulses were designed with these various symmetry arguments. They're very beautiful. But at some point, if you want larger offsets, we've gone as far as we can get with the symmetry arguments. And so, what can you do after that? And that's where optimal control comes in. Let the computer design something that you can't think up in your head. We saw this slide also this morning that optimal control isn't new, certainly, and it's not even new to NMR. And this is really the seminal paper that if you haven't seen this, I really encourage you. It's extremely well written and very straightforward, and it's pretty complete. It's got all the various issues of showing controllability and what the conditions are for controllability and linear and bilinear systems, all the buzzwords that you've become familiar with were done very long ago in this paper, but it was specific to selective pulses that I think I have a slide next that want to excite a region. So this is half the region. It's reflected around this vertical axis. You want to excite this region, ideally in this dotted line. You'd like to excite it with this nice square profile, and then everything outside of this you'd like to have zero. In magnetic resonance imaging, right, instead of these offsets of different constituents in your sample, that see these different electronic environments and see a different shielding and have a different offset, you only have a water, for example, is one possibility in the most common application of imaging. So you've got water at a fixed resonance, but then they spread it out with a gradient. So it's spread out continuously. So they have to be very rigorous in killing everything out here. Otherwise, it folds back into the image in this selective region. And there's a lot of work done on this with, of course, you can't get a pulse of finite time that's going to give you this nice sharp edge. So all these the filter design people have there's a voluminous literature by the filter design people coming up with what the criterion of the performance that you would get if you want, because you're going to get some ringing. So how do you control this ringing when you bring the pulse down? And so you can get very well controlled oscillations or ripple in the pass band, and also control the ripple in the stop band. This previous paper I showed you did this. Well, they designed pulses with optimal control, but then we had wondered for some years, why did optimal control just kind of disappear from NMR? And again, Stefan mentioned, we finally understood that almost at the same time the Chenard-LaRue algorithm came along, and it's very fast and powerful. It does this forward propagation and back propagation in a very linearized regime, and and has very well defined, because of these filter relations, empirical relations between, you specify how much ripple amplitude you want in the pass band and the stop band, you specify what your pass band frequency is and your stop band frequency, which controls this transition width, and then that, it's going to spit out in relatively few seconds the ideal pulse that will do this. The problem is that it hasn't been a problem for imaging. It really took over imaging. But the problem is, we'll see for continuing development, is this algorithm is very constrained. I mean, it'll spit out this beautiful solution, but you don't have any way to plug in tolerance to RF inhomogeneity, relaxation, all these other things that optimal control is so flexible in incorporating. So we came back to optimal control on high resolution NMR, where there's a lot of different requirements and opportunities than in imaging. We want broadband non-selective pulses. So we have this pass band, of course, that we're interested in, but effectively our transition width can be infinite. We don't really have to care what happens if it's a non-selective pulse in this region outside of the pass band. So that gives a lot more flexibility in the kinds of pulses we can design. There's often large, well-defined gaps in the spectra. We don't have to necessarily get perfect excitation everywhere in the pass band. There's regions which you can always count on not having signal that you're interested in. So again, there's more flexibility in terms of the kind of pulse we might design. We need refocused pulses that go specifically a point-to-point transformation. Everything goes to something like from Z to the X axis, as we mentioned. And whereas this Shinar-Lure algorithm, we'll get to this in a little bit, but it spreads things out in the transverse plane, which, again, they don't care about so much in imaging, because they'll do a magnitude image. And also, their dispersion in the spins in the transverse plane is gradient-induced, so they can flip their gradients and refocus all of that, but we have no control over we can't flip our chemical shifts and get that to refocus again. Stefan mentioned coupling networks, coherence transfer, all that stuff that I'm not going to get into this afternoon. We have this opportunity or need to have robustness to RF inhomogeneity or miscalibration and relaxation losses. And none of these is available to the Shinar-Lure algorithm. So real quick, everybody here knows optimal control theory, so we don't have to spend any time on this. As you know, you feed in an initial state at some time t0. You've got some evolution equation. You've got some target state that you want to drive your system to, and you come up with some cost function. Of course, there's other nuances here that you all know about, but you feed all that in, and it'll spit out the conditions for optimization. So specifically for us, right, we're feeding in, of course we can do this in a density matrix formalism or a Schrodinger equation or whatever, but a single spin, a system of non-interacting spins, lends itself to a very geometric interpretation of the net magnetization we get, right, as a function of, or as a result of this ensemble of spins in our sample have spin either aligned or misaligned with the field. Most of that is canceling, and then we have this net, maybe one in a million set of spins that has an excess aligned with the field, and that's the polarization, the signal we're actually seeing. So we don't really have to follow the evolution of all the ensemble spins. We're just going to deal with this net magnetization, and so we have some final state that we field. So this is a three-dimensional vector, a magnetization vector. vector in space. This is some magnetization vector. Typically, the examples I'll be given, this will be on the z-axis starting out. This will be on the x-axis. Our Bloch equation is the time derivative of the magnetization is given by this cross product, which gives us this rotation around the effective field that the spins see. Or we can write this cross product as some matrix times the magnetization. And then we feed in some cost function, which in generally in the theory, right, is your state that you want to control, this inner product with whatever your target state is. And in this particular case, it spits out the standard dot product. And then the conditions for the that we have to have to control the cost. I quickly made up this slide again just to sort of condense everything that we're kind of all doing. But I didn't have time, but this background's kind of weird. I tried to change it and it, anyway, more details with not time to, but I hope you can see a little bit this. But if you start, Naveen showed really thoroughly like last week or a couple weeks ago, you start with this functional J and go through the conditions that the variation in J be zero, and of course you get some very quick and dirty, right? You get some, if you say delta J, it's going to be some term times delta, I don't know what, in our case here's our controls plus some term times our driven variable, but this would be U or psi, or and then plus some term times our delta, what's left over, our Lagrange multiplier. So this would be delta lambda, and this is chi, I think, for you guys. So you want this to be zero, and then since these were arbitrary, you look in this term and you say, well, if I set my lambda at the final time equal to something, this goes away, then I get this other equation, and so on and so forth. Each of these terms comes out eventually to defining this Hamiltonian function, which is this Lagrange multiplier inner product with whatever your equation of motion is. So there's some, and more generally, some function that's your equation of motion. And if you want, then of course you add this running cost term or penalty term that typically is a function of just the controls, but it doesn't have to be. But in most of the stuff I've seen that everybody's doing, this is generally a function of the controls. And then if you do this, you get this inner product, right? It's very general. It doesn't matter what representation you're using. It's a machine, depending on your representation, that's going to spit something out. And for vectors, of course, it's going to spit out the dot product of the vector on the left with the vector on the right. So this is our Hamiltonian, and this cross product is cyclical. So we can get these three equations, and hopefully the, so I guess we got to turn off the lights to see the stuff in black. And so this condition that these things in parentheses be zero gives us this equation dH d lambda. Of course, if you take the derivative of this with respect to lambda, each component of lambda, right, just gives us each component of this, and that just reproduces the, and that's where we started with the equation of motion. That's why we're able to add this arbitrary function in here, because we've added zero to the whole Hamiltonian. Then if we take the derivative with respect to the control variable, we get minus, we get the equation of motion for lambda itself, which is this is minus lambda cross, it's lambda cross omega, which is minus omega cross lambda. That's the equation of motion for lambda then. And then if we take the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the controls, we get something also that should be zero, which in the formulations I've learned from, we take as the gradient, and we'd like this thing to be zero. So more generally, of course, then you can feed anything you want in here. Ours happens to be a matrix times a magnetization vector, but who cares? I mean, it's some other matrix, a Hamiltonian times a state psi, or it could be a unitary operator, a propagator times a Hamiltonian, all these things, or this translates to a commutator. I've played fast and loose with factors of I, but this commutator is here. Then depending on whether these are matrices or vectors or whatever space you're operating in, you're going to have some inner product defined in some way. Ours is defined in this way. If you've got these matrices, the machine, this inner product machine, spits out the trace of this thing on the left with this thing on the right, and the trace is cyclical. So you always get this kind of nice structure in these equations that dh with respect to the Lagrange multiplier gives you your equation of motion. The derivative of h with respect to your control variables gives you the negative of it gives you the equation of motion for your Lagrange multiplier, and the derivative with respect to the controls gives you your gradient, which you want to be zero. And so for me, this is the point where we don't want to get into this. The whole issue of algorithms, Krotov versus Grape, pretty much starts here. You've got something. If as Naveen showed, if this is an optimal control, then you've found your optimal control, then this derivative is going to be zero. But on your first guess, it's not zero. So now, what do you do about the fact that it's not zero? And it looks to me like all the papers at that point fork off and say, well, what am I going to do to drive it to zero? All these different algorithms are strategies for driving this to zero, and whatever other terms you have to put in and are devices to show that this thing is going to derive this to zero in a monotonically convergent fashion. So, just more of this. Anyway, we know all this. So in our case, well, there's a nice little picture, right, that we drive this, because it is a vector that's rotating around the field. So we put these control fields in. We drive this thing forward to some final state at each time, however many time steps you've got for your control. Then you've got this Lagrange multiplier, which at the final time ends up, I guess I didn't, here's this term here, where this, whatever your fixed cost is, the derivative with respect to your control states, turns out to be, if it's, well, I didn't put, it looks like I lost the, if you choose that, the previous cost that I gave as an example, where the cost is this dot, this projection of the magnetization on the final state at the end of the sequence, then the derivative of that with respect to M, of course, is going to be the final state. And then we have this gradient that we want to be zero. So we drive this forward, we drive the Lagrange multiplier backwards, or equivalently, again, for us, since we're not doing these updatings at each step, and this is just a vector, right? So we calculate the gradient at this point and run the gradient backwards. And so now we know the gradient at each step, and we know how to take the previous RF and push it in the direction of this gradient, taking a proper step. And when you first do it, they're far apart, but as you keep doing it, eventually, if you really find the optimal control that drives your initial state to the desired final state, well then, since they follow the same equation of motion, this Lagrange multiplier go back reversing in time along the same path. So you're driving these things closer and closer together. And Stefan, I think, or maybe one of his students had made a nice little movie for a simple system as you do this, and how these things all kind of start approaching each other and somehow we've kind of lost that. I'm not sure if we... So to get a quick, simple picture, let's design a simple, hard 90-degree pulse for a system that's on resonance, and we're going to take the initial state along the z-axis, the target is on the x-axis. We'll have our cost that we've just mentioned, so our Lagrange multiplier here is the final state, which is along the x-axis. And let's just choose this B1 field times t to be 90 degrees. We want to drive at 90 degrees, but let's guess completely wrong in the direction, in the phase of the B1. It should be along, we know it should be along the y-axis to derive the z magnetization to the x-axis, but let's stick it along the x-axis as our first guess. Then the optimal control algorithm says evolve this forward in time, and it's a one-step pulse, right? It just has one step, so we can kind of just do all this in our heads. We don't need a computer. So we evolve this forward in time. Then the magnetization is gone on the minus y-axis. We wanted it along the x-axis, so we missed sort of maximally badly. Then we calculate this gradient, which is m cross lambda. It's along the z direction, and that's at the final time, but we want it at the initial time, so we evolve that backwards in time, and it rotates around the B1 field and backwards in time in this direction, right? So our gradient then ends up at the end saying your original field, which was along x, should be pushed in this direction. So you have to take some step size, and you can just do some naive things and move the B1 field in this direction. Or if you do a line search, actually it finds it finds this optimal step to take, and it's pretty large, and in the first step it pushes the B field along the y-axis. But so it just keeps doing this, right? However small you take this step, it does it iteratively until you get to the right answer, which is along the y-axis. The other thing we can do is guess the right phase for the field, but let's choose the amplitudes too small so that when you evolve it forward in time, it just doesn't quite get there. Because these are the only two things we have to work with is amplitude of the field and the phase at which we apply the field in the transverse plane. So it doesn't get there. Now it's a little bit more favorable to us because then when we calculate the gradient, m cross lambda is actually along the direction we want. We take some step, it pushes it up higher, and it just keeps pushing it up higher until finally, you know, with a line search, it'll do it in one step. It'll push it along the x-axis, which is where we wanted it in the first place. And so anything that we do, really, I mean, this is a very simple example, but if you've got lots of offsets or you've got a more complicated pulse sequence, whatever it's doing is some combination of this amplitude adjustment and this phase adjustment. But of course, a more complicated sequence, you're not going to be able to follow it in your head like this. And I had really wanted to have time to now do the same thing for the Krotov algorithm. And a week ago or so, when I was thinking about this, I was trying to picture how I would do that. Because with the Krotov algorithm, we're going to have two steps, right, to be able to do this thing, to update at each step. That's the minimum. We'll have to have a two-step pulse, and anyway, I couldn't picture it in my head, and so I just figured we'll just leave that for later. But for some reason, riding in on the bus today, I was able to figure it out in my head, and it's pretty simple, but now I have to spend all day writing these stupid pictures and put them on the thing. So I sort of got somewhere with that. And if there's time and anybody's interested, we'll leave that for the end. If we start it now, maybe we won't even get to the end. We'll miss cookies. It'll be a disaster. So let's do something a little more challenging than designing a 90-degree pulse for a single spin on resonance. This is this thing we've eventually referred to, actually now named it the magic pulse, when he first started working in this and learning and really understanding what optimal control could do and really understood what this pulse was doing. He started calling it the magic pulse. What we want to do is get design a 90-degree pulse, which can cover a range of RF fields that are available in carbon-13 probes. Typically 10 to, is my understanding, 10 to 25 microseconds in the range of probes that are out there that people are using, which, again, just units is 10 to 20 kilohertz peak RF power. in terms of this, you know, B1 field being, or omega being gamma B1, the units that are typically used in NMR rather than how long the pulse is. And then in addition, carbon 13 has a 200 part per million chemical shift range, which if you've got a magnet that a static field that has a Larmor frequency for protons of 800 megahertz, that's about 40 kilohertz bandwidth. And so again, without having to spend a lot of time, if units are potentially confusing, we've got RF fields on the order of 10 to 20 units, and a chemical shift offset range that we need to cover that's on the order of 40. And in that early slide, you know, we showed how difficult that is. As you get your offset range much larger, this is a factor of 2 or even 4 larger than the B1 field you're applying. It doesn't have to turn on the lights because I'm just going to draw this. If we've got one unit here, right? Is B1, and now we've got something, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4 times larger. Our effective field's up like this with respect to the Z, it's just going to be precessing around the Z axis, right, for each little increment of the pulse we give. So unless we do something with lots of increments, and we're not going to be able to do much with this. So the initial states along the same as the original, the previous problem, the initial states along the z-axis, the targets along the x-axis, and but now we've got all these offsets. Stefan mentioned this. I don't, and showed a summation, but when we calculate the gradient like we did in that simple example, we'll be calculating that each time we do an evolution for some offset, or for it's going to be a combination of whatever the calibration is for the B1 field, this range of B1 fields that we can have, and this whatever the combination of that and the offsets are, we're going to propagate that forward. And the gradient will tell us this is the direction your RF should have been to accommodate this spin, right? But you got a whole bunch of them, so what to do about that? And so we basically average the gradients resulting from this range of RF and resonance offsets. So actually, this came up yesterday, so maybe this is a good time to mention this because we've been talking about this whole issue of, maybe I turned on the wrong, convergence of these different algorithms. Third time's the charm. Okay, thank you. We've got an equation like this, right? M dot is omega M. This is a vector. And all this convergence is proven. Either the grape algorithm and also the Krotov algorithm, that if you do these various steps, you're guaranteed to converge monotonically for some parameter or whatever. Like Krotov wants to optimize the functional. We're more interested in this fixed cost, but I think you are also. But now if you add this range of offsets, we can just write this thing as a big vector that has an M dot equal to some omega times m for each one of the offsets, right? And so we just got block diagonal omegas down here. So it's the same. It's still a vector. It's just a bigger vector with a bigger matrix and another bigger vector. So the proof is for spaces and systems that satisfy certain properties in these elements. And this doesn't change the properties these elements satisfy. So I think all of that comes out the same. I mean, it seems pretty obvious that it should, but I don't know. Maybe somebody disagrees. So we'll do this, and then same cost. And we also, of course, have other possibilities for costs that we'll get to in a couple of minutes. And then also something, we don't have to bring this in right now, but instead of putting a penalty function in, which we started doing some time ago, we clipped this peak RF at some value, 15 kilohertz. Since if we're, once we're ranging between 10 and 20, the nominal peak, we want to design this for 15 kilohertz, but then allow the fact that whatever pulse we come up with could possibly be scaled in its calibration so that it only spits out a peak of 10 or it spits out a peak of 20. So you have to input a guess, and in the early days when we were doing this, since we don't know what the best pulse is, we didn't want to bias the solutions that it might find, so we just, and also to show just the power of optimal control, there weren't optimization routines that we would use before optimal control where you wouldn't want to guess something as close as possible. Here's just nonsense, right? We're putting in noise, and then it spits out, kind of something that looks like garbage in, garbage out. But if you look carefully, you see the clipping algorithm worked at least. But anyway, whatever we're doing, anybody can clip it, so that might not mean anything.
So you're just clipping it, but then the next step, it will tell you, I still want to go higher, right? So what is that?
Well, in a problem with this, what we found is it would be bad, right, if the gradient said, go in this direction. And we said, well, you can go in this direction, but you can only go this far in terms of your RF amplitude. So clip it back to 15 kilohertz. If it only found that exact solution now on the next iteration, then we'd be stuck, right? It would be oscillating back and forth. But there's enough richness, I guess, in the landscape that it says, I want to go this way, and you slap it and say, well, you can't go that way, and it goes, well, let me go off this way then, right? Because now you've input something that it's smaller than it wanted to do, so it has to recalculate. It calculates a different gradient, and it finds a different direction to go.
I have one question about your noise. It's a given function of time?
No, we just put a random noise, took a random noise generator between zero and...
Your simulation is given by some function of time or completely random?
Yeah, this is completely random, within the limits of random number generators.
So if you proceed the iterative calculation, every iteration, the system fields a different noise.
No. This is the input pulse one time. Now it runs through on an iteration and says, change this in the following way. Then we input that the next time. It says, change this in the following way, and just keep iterating in that fashion. Is that what you mean? I mean, is that explain what you're
it's
asking?
So the system is just the initial pulse, the initializing the first field, and then...
Maybe. This is the RF amplitude, right, that we feed in initially as a function of time. This pulse was 2 milliseconds long, and this is the phase of the pulse at each step. So there's a matched amplitude and phase in the XY plane at each of these, and just arbitrary starting out. So we feed this in, it spits out this crazy thing, and so what does it do? Here's a little movie of the trajectory of the spin on resonance. So if you're looking at this originally, it's just, I don't know if it means a whole lot to the NMR people, but this is just sort of completely new kind of pulse in NMR. Something that's just, it's wandering around doing nothing intelligible.
Sorry.
And then the pulse, of course, looked like noise, and it looks like now we're testing it. It's you've screwed up. This thing didn't do anything. But somewhere in the last bit, it gets up along the x-axis, which is exactly where we wanted it to go. I didn't make these movies can be pretty big. Here's the what I just showed you. The path it follows. Here's a path off resonance, out near the 20 kilohertz off. It follows a completely different path. So this coupling we talked about, this different coupling to the field, it really is, for me, it's just astonishing. You're applying one. You have to solve this problem. You have to apply one single field, and every spin couples in a different fashion to it, and this algorithm has to find a way to drive each of them somehow to the same place, kind of like I had used the analogy of herding sheep. You know, they're all kind of running off in different directions, and something's running wrong, nipping at their heels, you know, but eventually they all end up in the chute and get shipped off to market or wool or whatever you're trying to do. So here's a simulation giving some more detail of I was a little lazy. Well, this is the simulation for that pulse I just showed you. It was designed between plus and minus 20 kilohertz. And so it takes the magnetization, which is originally along Z, as a function of offset and as a function of this peak RF values between 10 and 20 kilohertz. In other words, you can set your peak power to drive anything between 10 and 20 kilohertz, and it gives you the X magnetization of greater than 99% of the initial magnetization, and the phase deviation from the x-axis is less than 1 degree over this whole range. I mean, it's really kind of remarkable. But we had 2 milliseconds to work with, and so then the question is, I mean, 2 milliseconds is kind of long. How about 1 millisecond? And then on top of that, let me just go back quickly. On top of that, why Burkhardt will probably tell you that with good modern RF amplifiers that are linear, it's actually not a problem to get this kind of switching. But everybody doesn't have that. And if we could do a constant amplitude pulse and just do phase modulation, the phase modulation is easier to do. And so we ultimately designed that, and that's really the magic pulse, because it's 1 millisecond long. Pardon me?
Is that really easier? I mean, why is that easier?
Why to spit out?
In the amplifier, you can simply calibrate one amplitude easily. I see.
And from what I understand, just the switching of the amplitude is a lot more difficult for whatever reason than switching phase. Because I mean, your amplitude has to, right, to run from very small values and jump up very quickly to very large values, right? So here's this. Stefan started to show this movie. Stefan really. This was the way I originally showed this, but then, as you see, you've got to show it for each offset. And so Stefan suggested, well, gosh, you know, why don't we just take each trajectory? Here's these initial magnetization vectors along the z-axis as a function of offset, and then as a function of this RF calibration. And he had started to show you the movie he did some time ago, and I had another talk to give, he was somewhere, and I just wanted to see if I could figure out how he did it, so I also wrote this little program, and they start going, so for 1 millisecond, they're just, again, all of them are just going kind of crazy. There's no sense to this really that you can make out in any fashion, and somewhere along here we'll get close to the end. Don't blink or you'll miss it. It's not too long. It should right here. At the end. So it's almost like, well, what did you need that first? This is so. I cut down the trajectory to the last 20 microseconds. Actually, in a 1 millisecond pulse, here they are at the end of almost 20 microseconds before the end of the pulse. If you look closely, they're actually starting to get a little bit of coherence, not as a function of offset necessarily, but at least as a function of RF amplitude. They're kind of like dancing together a little bit. And then if we do this, they'll turn red in the last 20 microseconds, and then just whoosh, it's just unbelievable. And we almost have to see that more than once, don't we?
It is a magic pulse, isn't it?
It is a magic pulse. Does anybody want to see it one more time? Well, I do. Just one. Just humor me.
Okay. So, are the days of lengthy calibrations gone?
Well, we thought so, but you know, it turns out I don't know that people are necessarily using the. Ask that question at the end after people that wanted to go for cookies have gone. I can tell you that. I mean, there's actually an interesting story about that. So to remind you, this is all simulations, right? We put this pulse in, we've shown this crazy pulse, and I kind of left out this comment in an earlier talk. But experimentalists always ask, I mean, it's like, yeah, you've got this pulse and you can simulate it on a computer, but I mean, can you actually really do this? And so I put this back in for this talk, and I left it out for another one. But I might be out of phase with this. The it's like I'm standing up here claiming that I can summon spirits from the vasty deep, and an experimentalist is going to say, why, so can I, or so can any man, but will they come when you call them? And so we have to do the experiment, actually. So what you're looking at here is a function of offset here, and as a function of RF calibration. You do, it's probably water or D2O in some kind of, so Burkhardt knows exactly what it is, right? But it's a single resonance line. So you do the experiment at a single resonance. You plot the peak. You get it phased the way it's supposed to be phased. Now it's along the x-axis. Now you start offsetting your transmitter, get that peak again. Now you don't do any more phasing, and you just stack up this plot like this. And then you do the same thing over again by changing the attenuator on your RF channel, so you're spitting out this fact zero, the fact between here and here is this factor of two we were talking about in the RF calibration. So, but the point is, this is a real experiment, and it just gives this beautiful flat profile as a between the magic pulse. Eventually was designed for, also we increased the offset range. It's plus or minus, it's 50 kilohertz offset range, and it's tolerance to a factor of two in RF and homogeneity. So there's other things we can do as well, play little tricks. If our cost is this, and we want to drive everything to the x axis, we have to have a very, very high quality factor. If you have, for example, a quality factor of 0.95, I mean, that's very, in terms of your signal strength, that's very good for NMR, but you take the inverse cosine of 0.95, you'll get 18 degrees. So you're 18 degrees off the x, oops, I don't want to blind somebody here. You're 18 degrees off the x-axis if you have 0.95, which is a signal you'd be very happy with. So instead of using this cost function, let's use this sort of modulus squared of the difference, but also weight it by something. And is this below the... Anyway, these A's are 1 for x, 1 for y, and let it be 0 for z. We don't care what happens to z. In other words, we have a lot of we can let the z phase be anything, as long as it's tight with respect to the x-axis. If it's 0.95 with respect to the z-axis, we have that 18 degree phase again. But that's not something that you measure in the NMR spectrum. You get a nice phase spectrum, and so this is a result from one of the papers that if we change this cost function in the pulse to this cost function, we get this nice tight profile, and it gives us a lot of freedom to modify whatever our performance parameters are. We use this to drive the pulse length down from like 500 microseconds. Remember, this pulse I showed you was 1 millisecond. Well, okay, if that's too long, what can we drive it down to? This isn't for the magic pulse, but we took 500 microsecond pulses and got similar, we got better phase and not better phase. We ended up with the phase that we would have at a larger pulse and a signal of 0.98 instead of 0.99, and reduce the pulse length to 125 microseconds. So a few more possible applications. Please replace the lamp. Well, that's not my, so I better hurry. The thing's going to burn out. And we looked at 50 kilohertz. Electron paramagnetic resonance has even larger requirements in bandwidths. So we designed, but we have little, this was something we just tried. Instead of having to get, since the gyromagnetic ratio for the electron is so much larger, we can sort of afford to throw away signal in principle. And instead of having to drive everything to one, let's drive it to a much smaller value and see what we can get. So this is a 50 microsecond pulse with a 15 kilohertz again maximum RF, and it gives us bandwidths of almost a megahertz here. Again, just this flexibility of optimal control to kind of put in and say, well, I don't care if I have one. What if I'm willing to trade off some of my signal? What can I get with bandwidth? Another thing, Burkhardt will talk in more detail about this, but we've been talking about this regime here where we drive everything to the x-axis. And our cost function, if everything's along the x-axis, is just this cosine phi is 1. This is our cost function here. But this r is defined as this off-resonance. What's the precession that you would have in the transverse plane during the pulse if it was just lying in the transverse plane, right? Delta omega tp is the precession you would have, or the dispersion in the transverse plane for each of these offsets. And what if the pulse produces 1, it'll produce, if r is 1, it'll produce the full dispersion in the transverse plane during the pulse. If r is 0, there'll be no dispersion in the transverse plane. It'll all be along the x-axis. And these Schnarr-Larue pulses I mentioned are r equal a half pulses. If you allow that, so you have this linear phase in the transverse plane at the end of your pulse with all the magnetization fanned out, sort of half of what it would be during chemical shift precession without the pulse, we can easily go from plus or minus 25 kilohertz to plus or minus 75 kilohertz. And then if you allow r to be unconstrained, in other words, we don't care where it goes in the transverse plane, just put it in the transverse plane. And Burkhardt has done a lot of work with this. We'll have a chance to talk to him about what cost he used. We actually never discussed this with him, but we just our cost was to have F, our target be the Z component of F, which should be 0 if we're doing a 90-degree pulse. We made it more general in case we wanted 10-degree pulses or 20-degree pulses or something. But once we say our target is the Z component of our magnetization, then the transverse is 1 minus Fz squared. And now our cost, which is m dot f, is mz Fz plus whatever this magnitude of the transverse magnetization that we get times the magnitude of our transverse magnetization target. Fz will be defined differently depending on whether we had a 10-degree pulse or a 90-degree pulse, so forth. But for a pi over 2 pulse, our cost is just whatever the transverse magnetization is. And as you see, then, if you don't care what the transverse magnetization is, you can get bandwidth with the same RF of again, almost, well, really, it is a megahertz, plus or minus 500 kilohertz, for an RF magnitude of only 15 kilohertz. And the pulse is, you know, whatever the pulse looks like. You can imagine it's kind of complicated. I'm not showing pulses anymore, except this one. There's another application with toroid cavity detectors. This is something that Klaus Velk has, I guess he was originally in Berlin. Maybe Stefan knows better. He's in it, formerly the University of Missouri. It has a different name now. But there are cavities that allow you to do measure systems at very high temperatures and temperatures, and allow you to monitor in situ catalytic reactions. But they have a very large, it's a toroid. It has a large RF gradient, which can be even larger than this factor of 2 that we showed for the calibration free pulse. So factors of 5 or 10 limit the applicability of these pulses to do standard NMR pulse sequences, which would allow you to do all sorts of interesting things here, and there's applications to chemical shift imaging. So we designed a pulse. This, the red is the amplitude. It doesn't matter. We designed a pulse that over this, this is the optimization region that we aimed for. I can't read it up there because the lamp is in the way, but it's the X magnetization as a function of the peak RF amplitude or inhomogeneity and the offset. And this is the MX, so it's 0.995 over this target region over a factor of 5 RF inhomogeneity. And the reason we can do that is because our offsets are much smaller. We did this large resonance offset and large RF calibration or miscalibration inhomogeneity, but we always knew if we didn't have to have much tolerance to RF inhomogeneity, we could get much larger bandwidths. And so then the next step is, well, it's probably true that if we don't have to have very large bandwidths, we can get even larger tolerance to RF inhomogeneity. So it looks like this is the case here. And unfortunately for his toroid cavity detectors, they have relatively small offsets. And this is the deviation of the phase from the x-axis. It's only, you probably can't see it, but it's 0.3 degrees over this target range. So very promising, and we kind of hope to do some exciting things, both with these EPR applications. And this slide following from EPR was supposed to show the other tricks that besides losing signal that we can do to get larger bandwidth, which we will need. And with these toroid cavity detectors, it can really open up both of these fields to really true Fourier transform NMR. So. And this is pretty close to the end here. Relaxation compensated pulses. We just have to add this. It's the Bloch equation with this relaxation term. And if you go through everything, it's an example. The equation of motion for lambda, right? Remember, was the derivative of h with respect to m, and. This m0, so it doesn't depend, right, on m here. So you get here's an example where you get a slightly different equation of motion for lambda. But it doesn't change the grade. If the cost, the fixed cost is m dot f, your gradient is still the derivative with respect to the controls. Your lambda at the final time is the derivative with the cost with respect to m. All that stuff stays the same. So anyway, we just make these small changes to our existing programs, and this is the same. So this is the same pulse, this magic pulse. That had a pulse length of 1 millisecond, and the blue line is how the pulse performs as a function of offset. So, and this plot is for the nominal RF of 15 kilohertz, but if you operate this pulse, it's 1 millisecond, it's a little bit long. The green lines for a T2 and T1 equal to 5 milliseconds. Some reasonable getting close to the pulse length. Your pulse length is some fraction of the reasonable fraction of the T1 and T2 relaxation times. We're losing a lot of signal with this pulse, and if we bring T2 and T1 down to 1 millisecond, we've lost quite a bit of signal. So then we do this, and here's another plot with T1 is always in, and with no, these plots below here are with no T1 relaxation, but the same T2 relaxation, same kind of thing we see. So this relaxation compensated pulse basically finds a trajectory, and the picture is pretty simple, right? You can send spins from the z-axis to the x-axis, but then they're all starting along z. But if at the beginning of the pulse, you really don't do much. You got very little happening except you're moving them off the z-axis just a little bit. So they're not perfectly along the z-axis, but they're getting in positions around the z-axis where they're not losing any signal or appreciable signal because of T2 relaxation. And the T1, as long as they stay along z, it's actually helping you, right? So move them around and get them in a position so that at the end you can give this quick pulse and send them down to the transverse plane very quickly and not have these losses. So it is possible to find these paths, and in all these cases we get a great deal of the signal back. So, cookies, we don't have to do imaging. This now comes back to imaging, selective pulses, and I talked to the imaging people. These are left over from a talk I gave to imaging people. But it brings us full, and the reason was because we come full circle back to selective pulses now. Now, I mean, we do need selective pulses. There's things that we can do with selective pulses that the imaging people can't do, and it was trying to show them that maybe you'd be interested in looking at optimal control algorithms again. So here's a selective pulse we designed again, we don't spend a lot of time on this, but just pictorially, right? Here's an existing, these E snob are existing pulses. This is a function of plus or minus 20%, plus or minus 10% field inhomogeneity, and how this existing selective pulse without worrying about what this bandwidth is and all these issues. This is what the existing selective pulse that's in common use is able to do for a pulse. The pulse length is 1 millisecond, and if T1 and T2 are also 1 millisecond, it loses quite a bit of signal. And this selective pulse, which we've designed, that's relaxation compensated, selective excitation by optimized pulses, does this much better and gets us back a lot of the same signal. And in addition, it does a lot better in this transition width, as you see also. And here, this is this East knob pulse is sort of a shifted Gaussian kind of pulse, and our pulse kind of, as you see, here's the relaxation strategy. It kind of does nothing, very, very little at the beginning of the pulse. Then it kind of shoots up to a maximum value, which would kind of be like a hard pulse, but it's got these little wiggles and stuff to fine-tune how it's kind of moved everything around in position around the z-axis, and then boom, at the end, kind of a hard pulse, just send them all down to the transverse plane. And so this is actual simulated. It's a pulse designed, right, as a function of offset and as a function of RF calibration, and we just tell at each offset and each value of the peak RF what we want the magnetization to be, either 1 along the x-axis or 0 along or 1 along the z-axis. And so this was a result of these pattern pulses that were mentioned and or at least on the tree in Stefan's talk to show that we can really manipulate these spins to a very high degree of accuracy. ENC stands for Experimental NMR Conference, and we were looking at this. I think we all agreed that it's time to recalculate the pulse and put the end up here instead of ENC. It doesn't necessarily mean people. Here's the same thing with the Krotov algorithm. I'll end here. Anybody that's interested or wants to run and get cookies can do that, and we can ask questions after cookies. Or now I'm insulting you, saying you'd rather go get cookies than ask questions, aren't I?
All right. So I think people who want to leave, I think, should be able to leave.
Yeah, not everybody's interested in the algorithm, but in probably 5 more minutes, I can show you go through the same steps for the Krotov algorithm as we did for the grape algorithm and see what's different. Or go get cookies, and I'll stay here for 5 minutes, and whoever's back here in 5 minutes, I'll talk about it.
Come back.
Yeah, sounds good. I might even go get cookies. Who says I have to stay here just because I'm giving the talk?
It really is a measured pulse, isn't it?
It is a measured.
The big problem we've got with carbon is even pink, because you don't have any dark signal in that system. That gets you 90-degree pulses. It's a CCNP chemically induced dynamic nuclear polarization.
It's what induced?
Chemically induced dynamic nuclear polarization, basically laser pumping and nuclear magnetization. And the dark signal there is vanishing.
And actually, based on this pulse, it is non-intensive, like the book that is all about it.
Have you got the sequences? The actual waveforms varying.
But smoking. We have it for Buka. Actually, the nice thing is you can, out of this, you can construct also refocusing pulses. Mm-hmm. And actually, we have demonstrated full truth.
So they are universal pulses.
They are not, but you can construct them universal pulses.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What about coupling? Have you got coupling in the spins? Then it's becoming more challenging, I guess.
Well, the coupling is an option.
Actually, even if the, I mean, since the pulse is so complicated, if it's happening, then it's almost a
challenge, unfortunately.
Go in and see if there's cookies, or did I go over and now they can't get any cookies?
Cookies. It's anyway, cookies disappear.
No, but I mean, so if the talk went past when if the cookies haven't been put out yet, then they have a chance to get cookies. If I went over when they put the cookies out, then no cookies for anybody. No soup for you. It looks pretty close. Actually, I shouldn't have told everybody that it was an end. It's like, well, that's pretty close to end, but how come somebody could say,
what's a G? It's not D.
It's not a D. It's like almost like you couldn't do a D. How come?
This scientist designed pulses using MATLAB.
Yeah.
And you start from MATLAB, yeah, mm-hmm. But why you after that switch to
just because it was run? Just because it was, you know, the programs run faster, and that's all. We have lots of iterations, or we've got large. Are your systems that you use MATLAB for? I think if you're in the atomic or molecular community, you have this.
No, I'm in NMR.
Oh, you are in NMR.
I'm working with that situation.
Ah, okay. I think what kind are they? Imaging pulses? I know he's doing some imaging.
I think we did some excitation pulse for sensory hub.
And is there resonance offset, or is it just?
No, there's no resonance.
Yeah, see, so there's not as much calculational overhead.
Yeah, quadrupolar coupling
at the same time.
So it's nice because you have this nice. You can use your MATLAB has these nice exponential matrix calculators, and you can put all that stuff in there and not have to write the.
Yeah. At the same time, I didn't know that we probably can use MATLAB for the supercomputer also.
No, I know. But it's
parallel.
I mean, then you'd have to make it. You can make it parallel. MATLAB has this kind of parallel capability to put the program
in. Parallelize as many GPUs as you have. So 8 is the latest version, so than 9.8. You've got 8 cores. Run across 8 cores.
But please check. When I work with Anatoly Kitrin in Kent State, once we use this supercomputer facility, and then our collaborators also use that MATLAB or some, open MATLAB replacement to try some calculation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, it might be possible.
But is it easy to set up?
You set up it like this, you take a for loop, the outer loop, shall we say, is a loop that loops across the offsets or in your system, and you replace 4 with par 4. And MATLAB automatically parallelizes that loop across as many CPUs as it does.
Oh,
so your original 4 statement is replaced by this, and that's the only change you have. And in fact, if you don't have any, if you only have one processor, for example, it will automatically fall back to a serial execution.
So this is doing it, not sending it to some other, it's doing it just on whatever system you have. And
if you've got two cores, it still can do it, but it's more expensive.
Yeah, I think you have work to do, but they're one of the few I haven't seen. So they write the programs that'll run. If you've got two processors,
and it'll do the
two processors. So like what we do. Suppose you're taking an average of two numbers, mm-hmm. it's using shared memory, not whatever the other distributed memory.
Yeah.
So it's going to write it in every other slot and add them all together at the end, and
that's right.
Pretty painless. Very nice.
It is quite painless. In fact, if you've got a cluster, as I said, the big parallel processing toolbox for MATLAB, it's licensed per CPU, so the licensing is ridiculously expensive. The only place in the UK that has it is the Oxford Supercomputing Center.
Mm.
But
yeah.
There you can parallelize MATLAB across 800 processors.
Yeah. And I think that's the same thing at the Ohio Supercomputer. They've done the same. You know, you can run MATLAB on their system and
they just provide you a little file. You say MATLAB pool, give it the name of the little file, and then it threads your powerful across 800 processors. So user aside, it's completely painless.
Yeah.
2000 and MATLAB 2007 was extremely painful. I mean, to set it up for parallel execution, crazy. MATLAB 2009A replaced force with park force, push the button, that's it.
That's good. Very nice.
It's been a transparent button. So it's got park force everywhere, well, wherever appropriate. So yeah, my laptop would fold back to serial execution on my workstation and runs across 8 cores.
It's possible. I mean, Intel has done that for their chip, because if you compile for Fortran, if you compile something, you'll see that it'll spit out. It's vectorizing this loop, vectorizing that loop, doing all this stuff. But I think if you've only got one core, you haven't really. There's probably some tricks they can do, but
The registers on a single core are superscalar. They're not vector registers, but they're superscalar registers. There's the SOC ones. What would happen is they were designed to handle triples and quads of double precision numbers. So it's not Cray-style vector algebra, but it still can do things in big chunks. Mm-hmm. So what was that compiler? I think it's Portland compiler.
There's Portland group and
auto vectorize things. And I think they take advantage of that superscalar capability. Mm-hmm. I think the last processor, which was proper vector processor, was Cray. And the only market that they have is the US market.
Uh-huh.
But those things were running like crazy.
Gosh, I don't think, is it because it's so expensive? Because I don't think they'll have that market, only that market. It's not that that's the only market that's interested.
I think the problem there was the memory bandwidth. The entire memory you have on a Cray is cache speed. That is, it's the same speed as the CPU L3 cache, 50 gigabytes per second. And that has to be SRAM, static RAM, which is extremely expensive. So I think Cray's cache speed memory, I mean, can you imagine having 10 gigabytes of cache speed memory? I mean, it's going to outdo anything.
Excuse me. So yeah, Stefan, see if anybody's coming. If they're not coming back, then I'll just...
I think, yeah. 5 years ago, a single Cray processor would outdo 50 Intel CPUs or something like that. I mean, it would just simply stomp everything into dust. I don't know how it is these days.
Yeah, it seemed like things were catching up.
Mm. Well, they got bankrupt. They got acquired by a company.
Yeah.
That company changed its name to Cray. So the current Cray is not the same Cray.
Uh-huh.
That produce the same with silicon graphics.
Well, I did. You know, I had these little benchmark programs, and I put them on the supercomputer, and I ran them just in single CPU mode, just to see what's the processing speed, and I put it on the Cray, and I was surprised to see that the Cray wasn't particularly fast compared to the Intel chips. I was like, man, these guys are going out. This was a number of years ago. I thought, well, these guys are going out of business then, because here's this million-dollar computer, and I can get a PC that can do as many flops as the Cray. What's the point? The only thing it could do at the time was do stuff in parallel. That's what they, in addition to, but their CPU processing wasn't any faster, so it's kind of like, well, geez, you know, there's no, and now you can do it all on as these clusters, and no need for a Cray.
Well, good old times. What was it? 1998, Cray T3D. Quite a beast. Actually, I was told by, I don't remember who it was, Ray Freeman, that in the 70s, when Cray was the only supercomputer manufacturer, and the machines were producing things on a printer, that is, there was no screen, on a printer. Could print it out.
Yeah.
It says a usual mainframe would go screech, print things on, but Cray had special high-speed printers which could catch up with the processing speed. So he says that the paper tape out of Cray printer would fly out, hit the wall, and it would slide down the wall.
Gosh, I haven't seen. That'd be an interesting.
There was a talk. I don't know.
Have a laser. Have a just a laser printer in your office. It's like spitting paper out that, sending it across the.
Have you been at the last Chianti workshop?
No.
Ray Freeman was giving a sort of memorabilia talk, and he said, "Oh yes," he said, "we did it in 1958." He said, "Yes, See, years of Fortran appeared, and whichever program it was.
So are they, anybody coming, or should I just go ahead and
say? I think we should stop.
Yeah. So it's like, I think they're not going to want to see this anyway, because it's although I may have to repeat it, because it sort of raises, I mean, it's an example, this example gives a nice picture of, here's the basic Krotov algorithm, and so here's where I think we're having problems or questions or issues or so forth. So as I said, to do the Krotov algorithm, we need a two-pulse sequence. And so we'll just keep the same problem, that the B1 amplitude is right, but the phase is wrong, and it's on for, we'll just divide it up into two steps, you know, T over 2 and T over 2 instead of B1 times T. And we'll run the magnetization.
So you need two pulses, does it mean
two steps.
Two steps.
No, well, I don't think you can do it if you have one step, because you have to do this, or maybe I'm not thinking about it right. You have to do this update rule, right? I'd actually didn't sit down and maybe I could have made things easier on me if I'd really gone through it carefully to see if I. It just occurred to me sitting on the bus that you'd be chasing your tail if you do this picture right, and you got m starting out at t equal to zero, and in one step you have m at the final time, and we take this lambda at the final time and run it back here to lambda at zero. Well, now we have to do, I guess we could do this. You do this, so I'm wrong. It would be easier to show this, right? You have to do this update rule, right? Starting with, I guess it worried me that you never really get any richness, because the first step of the Krotov algorithm is basically a gradient algorithm, because you're doing this, whether you're doing the update rule or the replacement rule, you're saying your control at the k plus 1 iteration is either your previous one, we can either leave it out or put it in, plus this 1 over alpha, and I said the gradient that you'd have without the penalty function, whatever gradient, that's just the normal gradient we've been calculating, in other words, in our case, this is m cross lambda, but it's evaluated at this lambda 0 and this m 0. So this, you haven't ever had a chance to do this update thing, so you propagate it forward, even if you propagate backwards, now you do this one with this one, and it's always at the value it had, whereas if you put one in here and evaluate this forward the very first time, you've got this update rule, but now the next one, you have this m that's been updated, and you calculate this gradient with lambda at this point, which hasn't changed, and this m which has been updated. So there's never any update information if you only have one time step to your pulse sequence. So this was the simplest sequence I thought of that allowed you to do this update information. That otherwise there'd be really no difference. It's just grape with this fixed step size, right? Although now I am going to go back there and think about it a little bit. But anyway, I thought if I gave this example, somebody would say, big deal, it's one step. We never do just one step anyway. Let's do something with two steps that shows the issues. See, this is the problem, though. I thought of this on the bus, and I think everybody that's come kind of deserved a sort of a tight, well-focused sort of presentation. But instead of doing that, I was trying to draw pictures and do stuff so I could show this great thing, because I thought it would be interesting, and I thought I could probably wing it well enough in the talk. But let's turn this off, and see if we can make this clear. So we're going to start out in the same way, right? The B1 field is guessed wrong. the phase is guessed wrong. We do this. It'd be nice if we could leave a light on somewhere. So you'll have to keep this picture in your mind, right? We don't even have to propagate m forward, because we're going to start m0 is along here. We're going to propagate lambda backwards, and again, lambda lies along here, along the B field, so it never goes anywhere, right? So in every step, no matter what lambda is as you're it, when you propagated it backwards, it's along the, I mean, not no matter what it is, it's along the x-axis, it stays along the x-axis, that's easy to remember. And then how does the magnetization now, starting at its point, get updated by this rule? And so the replacement rule for Krotov is that your B1 field where you're starting out now down at this end when you want to update is 1 over alpha times your gradient. Well, your gradient is m cross lambda, so that's along the y direction. That's actually very good, right? It's saying put your B field at some value that depends on this choice of alpha. This is the part that's disturbing to me. Well, not disturbing, but I think it's a potentially a problem. Put it along the y-axis. So that's at that step, it's kind of way better, right, than the Grape algorithm, because Grape has to sneak up on it. It starts out here, and you keep adding stuff to it, and it slowly sneaks up on the y-axis. This already instinctively knows, boom, let's go to the y-axis. But this is, you know, this is some penalty that you choose semi-arbitrarily. You want it small, but it's just some number, right? You pick out of that 10 to the minus 3rd, 10 to the minus 4th, whatever. 2 times 10 to the minus 4th.
I didn't understand. You don't have an initial guess?
This is my initial guess. B is along the x-axis.
But then you're setting it to something else. You're not updating the guess. You're just setting it to something else.
Right. That's the replacement rule for Krotov, which they is like a huge supposed to be, and in some cases it is a huge benefit of the Krotov algorithm, that instead of having to take a step or update, it just says this is the field you should use, and boom, you go, and with absolute confidence that at least your cost functional is improving if you take this step. So you do this. It's along the z-axis. And so we don't really have to. So here it is, right? But it depending, you know, generally these alphas, you want them to be small. And Niels was saying he chooses 10 to the minus 5th. So this is enormous. 10 to the so B0 is 10 to the 5th, whatever, right? It's an enormous thing out here. But anyway, you can choose this to be anything. So it's somewhere along the y-axis. And now you do this update on M to go from where it starts at 0 to where it is at T over 2. And we didn't. So it's going to rotate. The point is, whatever it is, it's going to rotate in this this XZ plane, right? So it's going to end up somewhere here. And we don't necessarily have to know where it is to just go through the algorithm. It's here. It ends up being some phase in the XZ plane, right? Where theta is 2 pi times B1 times our pulse length, T over, times this half pulse length, T over 2. Well, T was 1/4 because we had B1 times T as a 90 degree pulse, right? B1 was 1, so T is 1/4. B1 is 1 over alpha because M0 cross lambda was 1. It was 90 degrees between them. And so theta ends up being pi over this 4 alpha. So whatever alpha you chose, we've got some phase in the XZ plane. So then you just keep doing that, right? Now on the next, because you're going to keep propagating M forward, but lambda you're going to leave in whatever values it was when it back propagated. So on the next step, you do the same thing. Your B1 that you want for the next propagation for the second step at T over 2 is 1 over alpha times your gradient with whatever M happens to be. Well, it's M cross lambda is some, it's still going to be in the Y direction, right? Because this is in the XZ plane. It's 1 over alpha times this cosine theta in the y direction is your B1. Whereas it looks like I forgot to put up here. B1 is now 1 over alpha times 1. It's just 1 over alpha. I should have put equals. I ran out of 1 over alpha in the y direction is up here. The next step you do it, it's 1 over alpha cosine of your theta in the y direction. So now it varies between, and then of course your magnetization, which was somewhere in this plane, is just going to rotate more somewhere in this plane. So it's some sine theta prime, cosine theta prime phase. And your theta prime is pi, again, it's 2 pi, it's this, so it ends up being 4b1 at T over 2. Well, and that's less than the theta, because now your B1 at T over 2 is the 1 over alpha that it was times this cosine theta that's between 0 and 1. So this theta ends up, it looks like I didn't erase this either, being in this set somewhere between 0 and pi over 4 alpha. So, and each time you do this, you've got a number that's less than 1. So your B1 gets 1 over alpha times a number that progressively gets less than 1. So if you choose your alpha, let's see, what was my example here? If you choose your alpha large, so that theta is small each time, you still, cosine theta each time is going to be it's going to be 0.999 something, right? You keep doing this iteration, you got a number that each time B1 is 1 over alpha times 1 the first time, 1 over alpha times something that's a little less than 1, 1 over alpha times something that's less than 1 the next time. So if you just do this replacement rule, eventually you drive your B1 field to 0, which actually is the I guess it's the optimization of your cost function, because your cost function was the fixed cost minus this running cost. Now the running cost is 0. Your magnetization doesn't go anywhere because your magnetization is 0. I mean your cost is 0, so your functional is 0. So it's found the solution that your functional should just be 0, but that's not very useful. But also it's a case where I'm thinking the functional was supposed to be some value, and it was never supposed to get worse. So whatever value it was, it just went to 0. So that's something but maybe this can be presented in the next time we talk about algorithms to the algorithm people, or we can go through it.
The question is how valid this is, because as Sanjay said yesterday, this protocol only works like
if you have... I'll continue with this. This is the replacement rule, and if you have small alpha, let's see what happens if you have small alpha. I've kind of... if you choose small alpha, then just arbitrary small alpha, you do oscillate. All this because each time you spin this magnetization vector around somewhere that depends on alpha, you're going to get a different value for the gradient that you use to update your B field, and it's just going to doesn't look like to me it ever has a possibility of driving it to the exact value of what the B field should be to get your target. Your cost, your m dot f that you're really interested in, is going to oscillate, and it's never going to get there. And people have seen this kind of thing in more complicated examples, so this is an issue, and for me this seems like, okay, here's the simplest example I can find that shows very easily where this oscillation would come from. But anyway, the Krotov people are going to say, well, anyway, we know all this. We don't use the replacement rule because it doesn't work. But, you know, the first papers you read, there was all these claims about what a fantastic...
But Sanjay said, well, it should work if it's a continuous function. So maybe the fact that you partition this in two subpulses, maybe that's why it doesn't work. I mean, Sanjay always said it's about the digitization.
Right, but
if you have 1,000 pulses, maybe it will work.
Well, I don't think you would see as much of this problem for sure. So, but we're always using. I mean, my point originally when we raised this issue in the first place was that anything we've ever done with the line with gradient with grade the line search algorithm, it may get stuck in a local minimum, but it never barfs like this, right? Even if you just only have one step or two steps, this whole issue of digitization doesn't cause the grape algorithm to fail. And the first point I made when this first came up was that Krotov may jump up and then it flattens out and does this thing, right? But the grape algorithm, it may rise up slower, but eventually it's going to get there. And if you have a problem and you don't really know how you should adjust your parameters, the grape algorithm is the best way to go, because it'll always get there eventually, or it'll do as well as you can.
You know yourself that, for example, at some points we also get oscillations with gradient algorithm, and also for universal rotation process, for example, I have the experience when you do not choose the digitization small enough, then you never will end up to the optimum that you want to get to. So I think similar things also apply to the gradient, to the grade algorithm. Maybe not as strong as for Krotov, but they apply.
I'm remembering an example that I don't recall the details of the example, but I found something that if you start with a certain input for the gradient algorithm, it'll never find the solution that I really wanted it to find. But I can't remember if that was just if it totally failed to find any solution, or it just found a different solution. I don't really remember that. But if you have a lot, if you're summing over offsets and you have a very complicated landscape of your function, then I mean, I could easily believe that these kind of things occur. But again, if the argument has to be that you've got to choose your digitization right, and Mikhail told me this this morning. You've got the same that your cost or your functional should converge to the digitization. So if you think you've converged to something, you change your digitization again and see, did it change much? Well, if you've got to do those tricks, you've got the same kind of issues that you've got with grape. And these advantages that Krotov is supposed to have over grape, if you start scratching the surface and digging, I find that they kind of go away. It's like, well, we have to adjust this alpha on the fly and make the, well, okay, that's what you do when you adjust your step size for each time or do a line search. Oh, we have to check our digitization. Well, then you got to go through all these iterations that were so expensive for you and do it again. So why not use grape and do line search and do this stuff? And it's just not so, you know, there was a certain fealty to the Krotov algorithm. In all the papers you read, it's kind of like, this is clearly the way to go. You just use Krotov because it does this stuff and it's always using update information and there's no way that can't be better. But it's like, well, you know, if you look, is it really better? There's just I don't know the answer, and that's why we're doing this now, but it's not clear at all that it really does better in particular problems. So this kind of thing. So maybe we're satisfied. I don't that you've got this digitization issue to deal with, and that always solves the problem. But you will have a problem here with if the pulse is not digitized finely enough. So we could probably run this with two steps, and then force to keep increasing the steps and see what happens if it ever has a problem. But so we'll have to see. I've got this picture in my head. I don't know if it's right, but this picture of evolving this to whatever it evolves in the transverse plane, I mean in the XZ plane. Suppose you now do four steps. You'll have four steps that are exactly like the first one. It'll go bunk, 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 bunk four times instead of two times. Now do 1,000 times. Each time with this algorithm, it's only going to stay in this XZ plane, and it's going to keep flopping around, going around and around. I'll have to sit down and think about it a little more carefully, but it doesn't seem to me that it's ever going to change the conclusion of this algorithm, which is you can't get to the final value of the B field that you truly need. You get to the right direction, but I don't. I think we can sit down and go through this.
Basically, yeah, I did it with this, and I mean, when your alpha is too large, when your alpha is too large, I mean, it is 1 to the minus 3 or so, yeah, instead of 1 to the minus 5, then basically your target function kills you because you do not go anywhere to the real optimum that you want to.
Because, right.
Yeah. So that's an issue. But for larger,
or smaller alpha.
Smaller alpha, I always calculate 1 over alpha. That's why I have difficulties at the moment. because that is something that is close to an RF field in hertz or so that you can imagine. And so in that case, then you experience that if the number of digits is large enough, then it converges really nicely. And I think it's because every step depends on the previous step sizes. Yeah, then it converges.
But it's update.
But the update rule that I use,
are you using
one from this one?
But the question I have, are you using this replacement rule or the update rule?
I'm using both. But basically, it's what I implemented was the case number one of yesterday.
Yeah, but that's an update rule. There's just one more issue that here's the replacement rule, and I'm saying I don't believe the replacement rule works at all. And there was a time in the literature, in the papers, Krotov is a replacement rule, and in fact they were saying that two weeks ago when I first started mentioning these issues. It's like they insisted Krotov's not an update rule; it's a replacement rule. Well, here's an example. I don't believe you can make this work as a replacement rule. And so now if you show them this, they'll say, well, Krotov, it's not a replacement rule, it's also an update rule. So they'll shift gears and say it's a replacement rule, and the result I get for the replacement rule, you have the same thing with the replacement rule, is you do this, I don't know, I didn't have time to put all this down. I think this is, yeah, so I don't have the replacement rule, we can just say. But you can see, if you're doing a replacement rule, you have the B1 now is the previous B1, which is in the y direction, in the x direction, plus this term in the y direction. That's the only difference between the replacement rule. So you get the previous B1 field in the x direction, plus this step size, m cross lambda, in the y direction. So it becomes very much a gradient. It becomes very much like grape. You take the previous value along the x-axis, and you add some step size to it. So it picks a very specific step size, which is this 1 over alpha times this gradient. But again, it depends on alpha. So you have to choose your alpha properly. I don't see how that's any different than choosing your step size in the gradient algorithm. You're still stuck with this, whether you do a replacement rule or an update rule. But if you do an update rule, I think this will actually work just with the two steps if you choose your alpha properly. But you got to choose, but that's what the gradient algorithm does. It does a line search. It says this is the
gradient algorithm and line search. They are not necessarily connected.
It's just
line search in the Krotov as well, right?
No, they don't. That their whole advantage is they don't want. I mean, their whole need is that they don't want to do a line search. They can, but the advantage is that they don't have to, because it gives them, here's the step size you should take. The step size you should take, whether it's a replacement rule or an update rule, it's adding this amount or this amount. It's either changing the field to this value or it's adding it to the previous value. And so without doing a line search, which is going to take you have to calculate this cost function, right, for step sizes around your original RF, so that's a whole bunch of time propagations that are very expensive for them to do. So the advantage of the Krotov algorithm to them is this tells us mindlessly what step size to take. But it looks to me like it's not so mindless, because you have to. And when I keep pushing somebody and dig again, they say, "Oh, but you know, we go ahead and we adjust this and we do." Well, then that's a gradient algorithm. Right, but I'm just saying, here's an example where the field on the next step is really easy to visualize. It's really easy to visualize that whatever M is, as it gets updated, always stays in this XZ plane. So you're always just going to say your B field is the previous one for the update rule plus something along the Y-axis. And that something along the Y-axis depends on this alpha that you choose. And if you don't choose a good alpha, it won't give you convergence to the y-axis in the most efficient manner. So you have to pick alpha carefully, or you have to go ahead and adjust alpha and let it be bigger or smaller as it changes. But that's what you do with the step size.
In your example,
if you use update rule, it gives you eventually good results.
Yeah, but the point is, yeah, yeah.
And if you use replacement rule, it never gives you good results. Yeah?
It doesn't look like. But now if you go to the update rule, my point is, you have to choose a step size. And if you're choosing a step size, looks like you guys have a talk in here, right?
Yes, of course.
No, we ran way over and